In the science section of this past Tuesday's New York Times, Carl Zimmer wrote about scientists who study evolution in New York City, so we thought we would follow up on that for this week's Please Explain to learn more about the field of urban evolution and the ways that urban environments are changing the animals and insects and even bacteria that live here. Joining us are Jason Munchie South, assistant professor at Baruch College, and Rob Dunn, associate professor of biology at North Carolina State University and the author of The Wildlife Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. It's published by Harper. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank
My
you
pleasure.
So much.
And Jason, you're studying mice in New York. Can you explain your research?
Yeah, sure. This all started about 4 years ago when I moved to New York City, and I was looking for a new study system nearby, and I was thinking, okay, I'll find something in the Adirondacks or the Pine Barrens in southern New Jersey, a rural area, you know, relatively unspoiled, somewhat like wilderness. And I started talking to colleagues here in the city, and I found out that there were a handful of native species still occurring in the city parks, and I just couldn't believe it.
Are those different than the mice we find in too many homes in New York City?
So the particular mouse I'm studying is the white-footed mouse. It's not the same as the house mouse that you find in buildings. White-footed mouse is native to the northeastern United States. It's probably the most common mammal in forested areas in this region. In the city, you will not find them in buildings for the most part, unless it's a little building inside of a park. Because they get outcompeted by the house mouse and the Norway rat, which were brought here by Europeans in the last few hundred years.
And we thank them for it.
Yeah. So this species...
But these are indigenous mice.
Yeah, these are a native species, and they diverged from the house mouse and the Norway rat some 30, 40 million years ago.
Are they all over the country?
There are different species of deer mice all over the country. This particular one... occurs through much of the eastern United States.
So what did you learn when you studied them and looked at their DNA?
Well, my first thought when finding this out was that they must be stuck in these parks, that they're not able to get out, so they're isolated. And we wondered whether the populations within each of the parks that have the mice are becoming genetically differentiated. So we first went and looked at the so-called neutral DNA, sometimes referred to as the junk DNA, because it doesn't have a known function, although we're learning more and more about what it does. And what we found there is that almost every population in the city is genetically different from the other populations, to the point where you could give my lab a mouse you found in a park. After a few days in the lab, we could probably identify which park it came from, which was very surprising. We thought
because the parks aren't all that far apart, are they? I would assume that the mice would go from Riverside Park to Central Park.
Yeah, you'd think so. And that's what we thought there might be some chance for animals to disperse between parks. But for most of them, it doesn't seem to be the case. Although, they are different, but they haven't lost a lot of genetic variation. So each population has a lot of genetic variation. It's very large, but it's different from the other populations.
And is that just simply because they're isolated from each other, or are they adapting to their specific environments?
Well, that's the second phase of the project that we're working on now. After establishing that they have these large, diverse populations that are different between different city parks, we've gone back with a collaborator, Professor Rachel O'Neill at University of Connecticut, and we're sequencing the functional part of the genome, so the 10% or so of the material that actually makes proteins, the coding regions of the DNA. And so far, we've sequenced about 10,000 genes, and we've learned what those genes do by comparing them to the laboratory mouse, which has basically the same genes with the same functions. And our current work is trying to establish which of those genes have been subject to natural selection and how the mice are actually changing in the city. And we have a few candidate genes that we think are changing.
My guests are Jason Munchie South, assistant professor at Baruch College, and Rob Dunn, associate professor of biology at North Carolina State University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about, in this case, we're talking about city mice versus country mice. But Rob, can you tell us about your research on ants in New York City?
Yeah, so I've been interested in a while in how much we overlook in our daily lives in terms of what's going on in ecology and evolution. And I think we're pretty bad about it. I mean, even as ecologists and evolutionary biologists, we tend to look far away. And in part, this started when I was working with a friend, James Danoff Burke, who at the time was at Columbia College. And he was leading this field course that took all of the Columbia College first-year students out across the city to sample ants and plants. And to me, as a mostly a rural guy, that sounded like a nightmare, because these weren't biology majors. These were, you know, early medieval studies majors and cross-cultural transgender studies majors. And so everybody went out to the field in their high heels, and it just seemed like a nightmare. But by and large, it worked. And one of the coolest things about that project was in going out across the city to sample ants, these brand-new undergraduates, 19 years old, found new things. And so, for example, those undergraduates discovered that an ant called Nylandaria flavipes, which is probably from Japan, although it's not totally clear yet, appears to be the most common ant in Manhattan. And nobody at that point even knew it was present in Manhattan. And so here was a really fundamental aspect of the living world in the city that anybody could have discovered. And I mean, and there are thousands and thousands of biologists in and around the city, but we tend to just overlook it. And so we've since begun to follow up on that.
Well, where are you finding these ants?
Everywhere? Everywhere. So, and in different ways in different places. And so we've done a lot of work on Broadway, just because it's nice to be on Broadway, and the ants like it too.
You mean in the street medians in Broadway?
Yeah, right in the medians. And so the cars are zooming past on either side, and we're right there in the middle, bent down, looking at the ground, seeing what we can find.
Go ahead.
It's been quite interesting. We already found another ant species not known from New York, the Asian needle ant, also from Japan. And just 3 weeks ago, I had three students up in the medians and then over in Riverside, and they found an ant species not known from North America anywhere, and that we've never seen in New York before, and it was in about half of the traps we put out over on Riverside and one of the traps on Broadway. And so here's a totally new invasion of a brand-new species to North America. We're not even quite sure what it is yet, and all it took was really looking.
Have you checked out the ants in parks as well? Are street medians as isolated an environment as the parks that Jason is finding his mice in?
They do appear to be in part. So we've not looked at the genetics yet. Jason's sort of ahead of us in that part of the story. And Jason, I'd love to talk to you about some of this.
Sure, anytime.
What we are seeing is that there's a whole suite of species that we would predict should be able to live in the medians based on what the medians are like, but that we don't see. And I think that probably what's going on is they're just not able to disperse out to the medians. And if that's the case, I think we expect to see the same kind of genetic differentiation in some of these populations of ants that Jason's seeing in the mice.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, you said that these ants that you're finding are from elsewhere, mostly Asia. Are they invasive species? Or do they compete better for the territory than the indigenous ants?
It's a real mixing bowl. So we do have a suite of native species out there, and so there's a really cool ant that anybody can go see in the medians on Broadway and really all over the city called the Phoenogaster rudis, and it disperses seeds. And so if you look at violets or trilliums or a lot of the understory plants, they have teeny tiny little fruits that those ants carry back to their nests, feed to their babies, and then they plant those seeds in their garbage and they grow up. And so those ants are there. But then we do also see those mixed in with ants from Europe and Japan. And so to some extent, some of these new ants are doing really well, but so are some of the natives. And there are things we know very little about. And so the most common ant in cement areas in the city is an ant called Tetramorium species E. And it's called Tetramorium species E because it's not yet been named. And it is literally the most common ant on any cement path that you'll walk along. And it has a range that goes all the way up to New England and south to Raleigh, where I live. And so here's this incredibly common ant that we haven't even yet bothered to name.
But I have to ask you about adaptation, because that's to some degree what our topic is here. If you find one of these ants in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then can you check out its DNA and compare it to one of the ants you find in the middle of Broadway?
Yeah, so we haven't looked at the DNA yet, but we've looked at some proxies for local adaptation, and we do see differences. And so, for example, the pavement ants, the Tetramorium species E that we find in Manhattan, are better adapted to the cold than the ones we're seeing in Raleigh. And so that's at least reconcilable with adaptive change. There might be other things going on there. And so we're not as far along as in that story, but it would be very surprising if we aren't seeing some adaptations to the city and to the particulars of the city. One of the things we're seeing in Raleigh, and we haven't seen it yet in New York, is that if we look in the hottest parts of the city, and they're very much like what we would expect for rural areas in 2050. They're much, much warmer. And so what we're seeing in those areas are ants that can deal with warmer temperatures in Raleigh. And so we are seeing these changes, and some of them may be adaptive. Some might just be acclimation to the new conditions. We also see that the urban ants tend to have more queens, as though they're living this new urban lifestyle where a great big colony with lots of mamas is a good one. But also may just be acclimation, not adaptation. We don't know yet.
This kind of research seems fairly early in its development. Jason, how long have scientists been looking at evolution in urban environments?
Well, I don't even think there's a coherent discipline of urban evolutionary biology yet that's been named. There is the related field of urban ecology, which I think both Rob and I are interested in, that's been around for the last few decades. There are two large projects, one in Baltimore and one in Phoenix, that look at those ecosystems in detail, hundreds of scientists involved. So really, just in the last few decades have scientists looked at urban environments.
Well, what is it about the city environment in particular? Does it put greater pressure on the creatures that live here?
Well, I don't want to leave people with the impression that lots of species can actually evolve to live in cities. The major pressure that's put on the ecosystem here is that most of the species go extinct, so they disappear. And what I'm studying are the few that manage to survive in this area. And the first thing you see once all these other species go extinct is that the ones that are left over potentially have the capacity to kind of take over the environment. And we see that with white-footed mice. Their populations in the city are much more dense and abundant than outside the city.
And, Rob, we see that with cockroaches in the city. Are there also rural cockroaches, or are they pretty much now all an urban phenomenon?
No, so most of the roaches we live with in cities are non-native roaches that have spread with us around the world. And I think that's one of the really interesting things about these new urban environments that we're making larger and larger is that, a fair number of the species that do well in them have done well in them for a long time and have essentially spread with us. And so that's true for roaches. It's true for bed bugs, for example, which have spread with us since the first, some of the earliest caves in which humans cohabitated with bats. The bed bugs made an evolutionary shift in that early environment off of bats onto humans, and they've been changing ever since. And so there is another body of work on urban evolution, which is about urban pests. And in that case, the evolution is typically in response to our attempts to kill those things.
But have they adjusted? Are cockroaches, New York City cockroaches, unique to New York City? Would they be pretty much the same as they are in where they were? I guess we brought them over from Europe, right? Many of them from Germany, if I remember correctly. Would they be the same genetically? Would they be the same in Chicago, Los Angeles, Tokyo?
So the German roach moniker is what the Swiss put on them, but most recent thinking is they're actually African. But so we do see differences in the groups we've looked at. But the truth is, except in the context of controlling pests, that we've ignored evolution to a great extent in cities. And so it's not to say that it's unique in cities, but maybe it's uniquely ignored. But we do know, for example, that house sparrows, if you look at house sparrows across North America, their body size is different as a function of local evolutionary pressures. If you look at house flies, you see the same thing. They've spread with us around the world. They were with Cleopatra in Egypt. And as they've moved, they've responded to local conditions. And I think people are starting to look at those stories, but I think we ignored them for a long time because they're less exotic than going to the Amazon, or they're less exotic than going up to the Adirondacks. Jason, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's been the trend, that we've been focused on looking at the most pristine remote environments as our models for evolution.
But so you two are pioneers. We're going to take a little break and come back with our two pioneer guests, Jason Munchie South, assistant professor at Baruch College, Rob Dunn, associate professor of biology at North Carolina State University. And you can call in with questions at 646-829-3985 or leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. We're back with Please Explain, looking at Evolution in the City with Rob Dunn, associate professor of biology at North Carolina State University. He's written a book called The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. It's published by Harper. And also with us is Jason Munchie-South, who's assistant professor at Baruch College. We've been talking about their research in general. And by the way, we invite your calls at 646-829-3985. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And before we get into some of the deeper issues, maybe we should take a few calls, although maybe they'll get us into the deeper issues. Amy from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. excuse me. One of the guests mentioned the white-footed mice, and I know that they are one of the hosts of the tick that carries Lyme disease. And I'm wondering if any of the parks have provide enough of an environment for them that people going to those parks need to worry about tick bites and Lyme disease.
Jason?
Well, that's definitely a concern. We're right in the epicenter of Lyme disease, and it's carried by a tick vector, the deer tick or the black-legged tick, which is very common in areas that have lots of deer and lots of white-footed mice. In the city, we don't really have deer outside of Staten Island, and I think that's part of the reason why we don't have as much Lyme disease as you might expect. There is concern, given the densities of white-footed mice in the city, that you could have outbreaks of Lyme disease, but it hasn't happened yet. We haven't actually collected data on this, but just anecdotally, there don't seem to be nearly as many ticks in the city as there are in suburban areas like Westchester County or in southern New Jersey. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there aren't really deer in most parts of the city.
But these are deer mice. Why are they called deer mice?
I'm not actually sure of the origins.
I mean, I'm never going to call them deer.
They kind of have a similar color to deer on their back, kind of a brownish color.
Well, thank you so much for calling us, Amy. Gail from New York City is on the line. Hi, Gail.
Hi, I'm on the Upper West Side. I've lived in the same brownstone for 30 years. The brownstone was built in 1885. Last year, I noticed two brand new insects that somehow made it into my third floor apartment. I've never seen in my life. I've lived here 30 years, so I know all the bugs. This is one of them was about 7 inches long, had about five legs on each side, and it terrified me. There were two in my house. I killed them. I haven't seen them since. But another one was a horrible, huge green bug that was, again, about 8 or 9 inches long on the front door of my building, very thin, wispy kind of bright green legs. It was not scared of humans, not used to them, and I was able to kill it, but it was terrifying. Is this because of global warming?
Rob, are these bugs that are coming up north from where you live in North Carolina?
So it's possible. So I think one of the things that's allowing some species to move north even before global warming is shifting them is that cities are much warmer than their surroundings. And so what we're starting to see in Raleigh, and it's conceivable in New York, is that in the most cementy sorts of patches of the city, that species that couldn't live there otherwise are able to persist. And so I think one of the things that's really interesting but not well studied is whether the cities then become a kind of staging ground for a subset of species as they move north. But the other reality that we see with ants is that New York also, because of all the traffic, but in planes and boats and everything else, and just people moving in and out, it has lots of opportunities for new things to show up. And so that's probably part of the reason that we're seeing these new species of ants we've not seen elsewhere first in New York City, is that they're arriving in a boat or they're arriving in someone's luggage and establishing there. And so I think the melting pot that is New York also has ecological implications for the melting pot of other species.
But I'd imagine living in a traffic medium, a street median, would also mean a lot of exposure to pollution. And do these ants just simply adjust, or does the pollution not bother them?
So certainly some of the pollution is likely to bother them. And we don't know for sure, as I mentioned, why some of the species are missing from the medians that we might expect to be there. It could be that some of them are more susceptible to some of the common pollutants. And a weird thing we see in the medians is we put out these what are essentially tiny lion traps. They're just little Dixie cups. And one of the unique challenges of working in the city is people pee in them and they poop in them and they take them. But the other reality is that there seems to just be lots of hair floating around the medians. And so the density of hair we get in those traps is crazy. And so I think there are probably lots of of weird aspects to living in a city that we don't think about very well. There's some work showing that if you look at where the sugar sources that urban species are getting are coming from, they tend to be from human sugar sources, which might also have some implications for health and well-being of these critters. But it's early days, though, still. Jason, do you have thoughts about the toxicology in the white-footed mice?
Yeah, sure. We've actually been taking soil heavy metal levels around the city in the parks where we work with Rich Shaw at the USDA, and we found that most city parks have much, much higher levels of heavy metals than outside the city, especially lead, mercury, and chromium. And in our initial gene scans to look for genes in the white-footed mouse that are different between urban and rural areas, three that we found using very stringent statistical criteria that are different in the city are involved in heavy metal detoxification. The metallothionein gene pathway, which has been found to operate in several other species in sequestering heavy metals and helping move them out of sensitive parts of the body. So I think that's definitely playing a role. The one site that's has really high levels and is a focus for future research in our mice is Flushing Meadows. It was actually an ash dump until the 1939 World's Fair. So, you know, burnt coal contains all sorts of carcinogens and heavy metals, and the levels there are just astronomically higher than anywhere else.
Well, most of our listeners, I'm sure, know the basics of evolution, but can you explain how natural selection is being applied to what we've been discussing here? Let's say the mice. Are these mice, you say some of them can live with the heavy metals that perhaps would have killed their predecessors. Has something gone on in their bodies?
Well, there's a couple different ways natural selection could be operating here. So the basic idea is that there's a variation in a trait in a population, and that trait allows some individuals that have it to survive or reproduce at a higher rate. And if that trait has a heritable basis, usually a genetic basis, and it can be passed on to the descendants of those individuals that have the trait, the descendants will have the trait, and then they'll spread it further, and then you'll see that trait and its underlying genes take over in the population. In the context of pollution, if there's some natural variation, that like this mutation in the gene that allows some to sequester the heavy metals, and that provides an advantage in terms of survival or reproduction, you'll see that trait become more common in the population.
So the children of two of the mice who have that trait are more likely to survive, and then it will change that group of mice in that area.
Right. We haven't actually established that in the field. You know, we're sort of looking at the genes first for statistical signatures of selection, but we're going to go back in the field and do the work to.
But doesn't the same process, Rob, apply to what we're seeing with antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
Yeah, so it's exactly the same process. And I think if the listener's left with one idea, it's that, you know, cities aren't special in terms of evolution. Evolution is just also operating in cities. But what's unique is that many of the forces that affect the evolution of species in cities are due to our actions. And so we have things like antibiotic resistance, where bacteria are evolving resistance to the antibiotics we use and potentially even to things like antibiotic wipes. And then sharing some of those genes, we have bed bugs that are evolving resistance to pesticides. We have rats that are evolving resistance to rat poisons. And so we have all this evolution taking place in response to our big, heavy thumb on those species. And so there's a very real way, I think, especially these species that live in our houses with us, in which we are very unintentionally shaping their evolution and driving in a particular, almost predictable direction. And then in places like parks, we're shaping evolution in terms of how we design infrastructure.
But I was surprised to find out that there's a thing called Klebsiella, an especially virulent form of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that is found in Brooklyn hospitals. I mean, why would it develop in Brooklyn hospitals, not elsewhere?
A lot of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that we see, they emerge in particular locales, and then they can spread or not spread. But it's not that difficult of a process from the bacteria's perspective. And so it happens again and again and again. And one of the reasons that it's so difficult to work with, for example, MRSA, the resistant staph, which you often hear about, and to figure out how to identify it when it's present, is that it's not just one lineage, that in fact resistant staph has evolved again and again and again. And so from an evolutionary perspective, perspective, it's kind of this beautiful story of the predictability of evolution. From a human health and well-being perspective, it's a nightmare that we keep facilitating in the way we use antibiotics. And one of the crazy news stories in that regard is the compound that's in most antibiotic wipes and creams and even antibiotic soaps and detergents, which 75% of people use, and I would assume that number mostly holds for Manhattan as well, triclosan. So there's some evidence that there's antibiotic resistance evolving to triclosan, and there's now even a suite of bacteria that appear to eat the triclosan. And so not only have they evolved resistance, but they've evolved the ability to consume the antimicrobial compound.
So are we making the world more dangerous by using these wipes and antibacterial soaps?
I think that's true, yes. We're making it more dangerous, and there's essentially no evidence that using those antibiotic wipes or soaps makes you any more healthy.
I'm sure Procter & Gamble is happy to hear you say that. Jason, it was discovered recently that some species of fish in the Hudson were resistant to PCBs, mostly bottom dwellers. The same sort of process?
Yeah, this was work by Isaac Wergen at the NYU Medical Center, and he found that a small fish called the tomcod that lives at the bottom of the Hudson River has evolved resistance to PCBs.
It would have killed other fish, the PCBs?
It can cause death in high doses, and it causes developmental abnormalities in the tomcod and lots of other fish. And this could be a very intense selective pressure, because if you're at the bottom where the PCB concentrations are high, they're essentially bathing in it. So any natural variation in the population that will allow them to resist PCBs would spread throughout the population very quickly.
Would the mutations that allow these fish to survive with PCBs remain after PCBs are cleaned up?
That's a good question. There's one study that was mentioned in Carl Zimmer's article as well about aquatic worms that evolve resistance to cadmium near a battery factory in the Hudson River. And then once the cadmium was cleaned up, individuals from outside the population dispersed back in, and the cadmium resistance dwindled to low frequency. A lot of times, you know, they have these adaptations, but there's some physiological cost to having them, so they may be reversed once the selective pressure is no longer there.
We have very little time, but I wanted to approach to discuss probiotics. We see that word all over the dairy cases in our supermarkets these days, and Rob, you've written about them. Can you tell us about them and how they work and whether they're doing something positive?
So I think that the idea of probiotics is wonderful. I mean, we're really good at antibiotics in the broadest sense of the word. We've spent tens of thousands of years trying to kill things and dissuade them from living near us. And so the idea that we might also favor things, I think, is conceptually really nice. I think in practice that the probiotics literature is very young, but there are some really great new studies. There was a recent study just last year showing in a mouse model that if you gave a mouse Helicobacter pylori, which is a cause of ulcers in humans and also some kinds of cancer, and then you gave it a specific probiotic bacteria, which is in some probiotics that you can buy at the store, that probiotic bacteria would actually kill off the H. pylori in the gut of the mice. And it looks like part of what happens is that the probiotic bacteria is actually producing antibiotic compounds, which are then killing the H. pylori. And so, you know, I think that's sort of the state of what we know about a lot of these probiotics, is that we know they could be good, and there's a lot of goodwill toward the idea of using them. And when we do these careful studies, there's the possibility of really cool ways of manipulating the species in our gut without using antibiotics and instead using these beneficial bacteria.
We have about a minute to go, so you have to make the answer brief, either of you. We've been talking about ants and mice and fish, easier to study. Should we assume that some changes are going on in the human populations of cities?
Well, the one thing that might be holding that back is that humans have a relatively long generation time. So if we think about the fish and the mice, they might have a few generations per year. So if you're talking about a period of 20 years or 100 years, that could be dozens to hundreds of generations for the frequencies of genes to change.
It's going to be harder. Obesity might not be related to this?
Over the short time scale of modern cities, it might be hard to establish that. There is evidence that some genes have gone to higher frequency in urbanized populations over centuries. So there's evidence from some populations in Europe and the Middle East that they have higher frequencies of a gene that provides resistance to tuberculosis and other diseases in cities.
Jason Munshie South is assistant professor at Baruch College. Rob Dunn, associate professor of biology at North Carolina State University. His book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today, is published by Harper. Thank you both so much for being on Please Explain today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
A real pleasure. Thanks so much.